All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome into another edition of the Pro Football Weekly podcast. I'm Eric Edholm alongside Arthur Arkush, bringing you another pre-draft, sort of post-free agency edition of the pod. Welcome in, Arthur.
Hey, thanks for having me, Eric. How's it going today?
Hey, it's very enthusiastic. I wasn't expecting that. Before we start, we want to send some good wishes. Everyone, I think, is probably aware that Jim Kelly has undergone another round of cancer treatment. I know a lot of people have probably followed his story. You know, just the brave struggles he's gone through, Arthur, the last several years. And, you know, I don't think it's just Bills fans. I think it's NFL fans everywhere who have kind of kept an eye on his story. Had surgery in New York, in recovery. It's a long process, but apparently the surgery went well. And he's just a symbol of strength, man. I mean, everything he's been through, it's been quite remarkable to see him continue fighting the way he has.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I would just echo what you said. He is, yes, a great example of resolve and strength. And everything you said, people should go check out, too. Jim Kelly's wife on Instagram shared a really cool story. There were a couple omens potentially during his long surgery on Wednesday, and a certain machine that he got hooked up at. It's pretty neat, so people should go check it out. But yes, definitely on behalf of everyone at Pro Football Weekly, we send our very best to Jim Kelly and hope he has a speedy recovery and continues to kick this thing as he's done so far.
Well, I didn't even know about the Instagram thing, so I'm going to do that as soon as we finish this podcast. We do have some business to get to, and I know Hub was down at the owners' meetings in Florida this week. A lot to talk about from that. And, you know, going into the week, Arthur, I thought we were going to kind of emerge with this catch rule. What was going to happen with it? We had heard this was going to be kind of leading up to this day here and that this was coming down the pike, and yet – it feels a little anticlimactic. Yes, they addressed that. But before we actually get into the details of the catch rule, let's talk about the new tackling rules that exist, because this seemed to kind of trump the news on that. A little bit surprising in how quickly this thing is kind of pushed forward. The new tackle rules kind of open things up to interpretation, to where there could be more penalties. There could be players ejected. We might be seeing more of a college style, you know, targeting type of rule. I know it's not, you know, apples to apples on this thing, but what were your initial thoughts and reactions when we saw some of the stuff that came out of the owners' meetings and prompted them to kind of, you know, push this forward through the competition committee and make it a point of emphasis for the 2018 season?
Yeah, I think the two keys, Eric, are A, the surprise factor. As you mentioned, yeah, it was kind of pushed forward seemingly out of the blue Tuesday. No one was prepared to hear that players will no longer be able, any players, not just defenders, but ball carriers, blockers, everyone on the football field cannot lower their helmet and initiate contact, or they are subject to a potential 15-yard penalty, and I guess in extreme instances, potential ejection. So that part was certainly stunning, and I have to admit, I mean, some of my favorite running backs of the NFL have long been celebrated for the way that they're willing to lower their head and just knock through a defender. And it hasn't, I think in recent years, it has been in the rules that it's not allowed, but you certainly don't see it called all that often, at least not a runner in the open field. So that part of it definitely has me a little bit leery. And then also just all the gray area involved, as you mentioned, we don't know what's going to be the difference yet between a 15-yard penalty and a potential ejection. We don't know. I mean, Eric, you tell me. It seems to me anyway that there are almost countless instances in every game where this could potentially be called. So I don't know where officials are going to draw a line in the sand, and I don't know if this is going to make their lives easier or a lot more difficult, much like trying to interpret the catch rule to us.
Yeah, just the other night I was thinking I should just watch an NFL game. Pick one random NFL game out of a hat. You know, Bengals at Browns, week whatever, and just try to count the number of times that happened. And to see, you know, is this the kind of thing where we're adding two or three flags to a game, potentially removing a player? You know, and my questions as we lead towards the May NFL meetings, they happen about a month after the draft or two or three weeks after the draft. This is where some of this will be clarified a little bit, like you talked about. 15-yard penalty, possible ejection. What about replay? Are we using replay to help determine whether these are ejection-worthy plays? You know, is it like a flagrant one, flagrant two type of thing in the NBA? How strictly are these officials going to call these things? And, you know, I mean, it was so funny to also hear some of the questions about, well, you know, some of the calls that were made for catches last year shouldn't have been called. there's always going to be that gray area that you talked about and that interpretation of what's legal, what's not. And I just have a feeling that they took one issue with the catch rule and may have solved that a little bit and replaced it with an even bigger question next year. What is a tackle? What is a penalty? And I don't know. This has led to a lot of confusion and kind of angst about the whole thing.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting too, Eric. We've heard from a lot of from former players on Twitter who've been pretty outspoken either for or against this. I don't know if it's just me. I can count on one hand the number of current players that I have seen on Twitter come and speak out on it. Actually, I think DJ Swearinger is the one I've seen for sure. So to me, it's a little curious silence from the current players. And I mean, we're in total agreement that, well, A, if you're going to open up replays for this, the NFL is trying to shorten games, not lengthen them. And I think they've got a whole separate issue on their hands there. But beyond that, the catch rule is so different because the NFL is a violent game. And I applaud the NFL for trying to have player safety at the forefront and try and acknowledge that if they don't change, maybe this game is going to disappear. But it seems like the game as we know it has largely already disappeared.
Well, you nailed it right there, and we'll have plenty to discuss on this, and it'll come up in the preseason when, you know, these plays start getting officiated. We'll know in a couple months how exactly this will be executed. So we'll put that to the side for a minute and revisit the catch thing. Obviously, the standard for a catch at least appears to be simplified. Is this going to make everybody happy? No, but under the new definition, I guess, of a catch, and plays like Calvin Johnson back, what was that, 2009 or 10, whatever the play was. Dez Bryant a few years back up in Green Bay. Jesse James last season. They're calling this the Jesse James rule in Pittsburgh, it seems. But now this three-pronged definition of a catch is such that the receiver has to control the ball. We know that. Establish himself in bounds in the field of play. And guess what? Our old favorite phrase, a football move, has been reintroduced. So we're getting rid of going to the ground, that whole thing. But, you know, such as if you're trying to gain the yard, you know, or trying to gain the line of scrimmage, out of bounds, first down marker, that sort of thing with the ball in the hand, you know, that's a football move by definition. So there is no more going to the ground in a place like the Jesse James non-catch last year would have been allowed. So your initial thoughts on, I guess, this redefinition or the clarification of the catch rule, which seemed to be, you know, something that they took a lot of, you know, opinions on from all over the NFL.
Right. And I still think it's going to be kind of a we'll see. And I don't think it's going to be a 100% we nailed it every time. There will be some questionable decisions still come September. But I think that the language has been cleaned up, at least to my satisfaction. And even more than that, Eric, I know that cleaning up the language and removing the gray area was most important, but I can't help but think that still kind of, you know, hovering over this is kind of just a common sense, sort of an unspoken common sense rule, if you will. Yes, maybe it still can be interpreted differently from one official to the next, but I still like the, you know, if you're in a bar, you ask 50 guys and whatever the consensus is, that still seems to me like where this thing is kind of headed. I don't know what you think.
The bar rule, yeah, we'll call it that. The, right. The saloon interpretation. Yeah, no, I think it makes sense, right? Anybody watching at home, I think would have thought that Austin Seferian Jenkins had two separate touchdowns taken away from him, that Jesse James got robbed, that there are other – like you said, it kind of boils down to common sense. And over the years, I felt like the competition committee, I don't want to say justified their existence, but made this so difficult and kept adding little phrases and words to it and changing the interpretation. I felt bad for the referees because right. They have plenty on their plates as it is. Voluminous rule book that the NFL has, but then to add this sort of gray area and have this feeling of, well, replay can clean it up for us and all that still exists. So you're right. I think we are in kind of a wait and see mode. Shifting gears a little bit, definitely not in wait and see mode. The LA Rams, you know, one of the that you and I have talked about on the side quite a bit. I mean, since our last pod last week, we had kind of speculated they were going to be in on the Ndamukong Suh Derby. They finished it off, one-year deal, $14 million, and not fake dollars either. This is real money he's getting. Let me ask you this. Number one, the impact of Sue, how big is it? Number two, positively or negatively or both. What does Aaron Donald think about this right now in your mind?
Yeah, the second one's particularly a fascinating question. Let me just say the Rams are still in wait-and-see mode. They're waiting to see if they can acquire every superstar in the NFL to play for the Los Angeles Rams in 2018. It's been a really remarkable offseason. But, you know, I think the impact, A, is that when you pair Ndamukong Suh and Aaron Donald in a sub package in the middle of a 40 front, I think you are offsetting any edge concerns that may have come up when you traded Robert Quinn, and with Connor Barwin getting another year older, you just didn't have a ton on the edges, but I don't think that's a problem at all anymore, if it ever was. So yeah, I think they're going to be the most imposing interior tandem in the NFL. I think Wade Phillips is going to have just remarkable flexibility. We know Wade loves to be aggressive. We know he now has a pair of just unbelievable ball hawks on the back end too. But I'm not even sure he's going to have to blitz as much as he might even like to when he's got these two guys just destroying the middle of the pocket. As far as the Aaron Donald thing, that to me is the really interesting part. My understanding, I can't remember where I read it, but I believe Les Snead did pay Aaron a phone call prior to making the deal and said, hey, I need you to understand he's going to get his money first, but we are going to try and work on getting this thing finished with you, that is. And that would, of course, be one of the richest contracts in NFL history for a defender done before the season. I think Les Snead has to know that he can have Donald going into this contract year after last season's holdout. Because it's just it wouldn't send a good message in terms of rewarding the guys who've been doing it for you, who've already been in the building. So it sounds like, you know, Donald is agreeing, and he said he just wants to do whatever's gonna be best for the team, and certainly bringing in Ndamukong Suh is gonna help. But it could create kind of a potentially awkward situation. It certainly will create one if they're not able to get something done with Donald.
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, and we'll talk about guys like Odell Beckham and all that down the road in here in a minute. But just for the team that they have right now, they've already traded for Marcus Peters. We know they have to, you know, at least consider a deal for him at some point. Todd Gurley down the line, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, Jared Goff, even with the fifth-year options for both their former first-round picks. I mean, you know, this clearly puts them in kind of win-now mode as they, you know, a year or two, a couple years from now, get set to move into their very expensive, approaching $5 billion stadium out there in L.A., so we can understand the motivation to push the gas pedal down. I agree with you 100%. You know, obviously Aaron Donald has been, you know, one of your best players dating back to St. Louis, one of the few dominant players on either side of the ball for that team, and consistently so. You understood why he held out last year. You understood why he, you know, would want to get paid sooner rather than later. And yet, at the same time, as you pointed out, not seeing those double teams, you know, getting clear lanes. He could set the sack record. Sue could have a monster season. This defense could win a title or help them win a title. So many things to unpack in this deal, but it is fascinating. I guess who's their best defender, right? I mean, you know, just like you can make a case for any of the three guys, Donald, Sue, Peters, Joyner, LaMarcus Joyner, who they franchise. So what a unit. I mean, you could give an average defensive coordinator that group, and I would think they would still be able to have pretty good success with him.
Yeah, I mean, to have, you know, arguably the two best players at their respective positions in Aaron Donald and Marcus Peters, it's just amazing. But I want to make sure I'm very clear on this. I'm not sure that this doesn't even potentially increase Aaron Donald's leverage a little bit. I don't think for a minute that Snead is thinking maybe Ndamukong Suh is my Donald insurance if things don't go right. I just think this kind of ups the ante and increases the pressure on the Rams to make sure that the defensive MVP is happy come September, and ideally a lot sooner than that.
Right. Most likely, I think it would make sense that Sue plays 1 year and then moves on, you know, goes somewhere else after next season because they have to take care of all these other players, including Donald. And So, yeah, it's a fascinating NFC race. We've got all these teams kind of reloading at the top. The Eagles have done a good job of keeping their core in place. You got the Vikings making big moves this offseason, the Rams as well. Other teams still in the mix like the Saints, et cetera. So fascinating stuff happening up at the top of that conference.
Yeah, no doubt. Eric, the AFC better kind of get it together because the NFC seems to, just in terms of the sheer number of talented teams who are really viable Super Bowl contenders, I don't know. I see a lot more in that conference than I do in the AFC at the moment. We'll be right back.
All right, well, let's stay in the NFC, Arthur. And as we kind of teed up a minute ago, Odell Beckham Jr., there was a lot of talk this week, you know, with all NFL teams down in Florida for the meetings, that he possibly could be traded. And, you know, there were some conflicting reports. Is he being dealt? Is he on the market? Are they accepting offers? But, yeah, the New York Giants appear to be at least listening to the possibility of trading him a year before he's set to hit free agency. And you know, it was a tough season for him, no question about it. Giants start slowly. He gets injured, out for the year. Then this video surfaces recently showing him doing something or other. Oh boy, I don't exactly know what to make of what I saw in that video. But so he's at this flashpoint in his Giants career. Possibility of him getting traded. What percentage or do you put on that? Or do you really think, and again, it sounds like there's some talk out there, but is he getting moved? Do you think he's getting traded here and, you know, maybe even before the draft?
Eric, I think the percentage of the probability of the Giants actually securing two first rounders for Odell is probably less than 5%. I just don't see that happening. But I got to tell you, you got Dave Gettleman coming in, and you know well, you covered the Panthers very closely and understand how David Gettleman has operated, kind of a no-nonsense, all-business type of guy. I think this is pretty much a coin flip. I really do. I think Odell, it's maybe 45% chance, I'll say, that he isn't in a Giants uniform, just because I don't think, and it goes against the way that we thought the Giants were attacking this season, how they're in all win now mode and all that. But I don't know. I get the sense that the Giants ownership is not fully comfortable with Odell as the face of their franchise because he hasn't really matured the way that maybe you would think. I don't have any insider info on this. It's just kind of my hunch. What's yours?
Absolutely. No, I mean, look, they're the last, 13, 14 years, they've had Eli Manning as their ambassador, as the face of the franchise. And, you know, Eli's gone about his business one way and in a very professional way. And, you know, even when he was benched last year, handled about as well as you could have hoped or imagined from anybody in that situation, hurt as they may be. Whereas Beckham, as gifted a player as he is prone to these sort of emotional outbursts, whether it's on the sideline, in games, or having distractions off the field, whatever, however you want to, you know, define that word, distraction or whatever. He always seems to be in the news. And John Merrick, the owner, clearly doesn't like answering questions about him. He said as much this week. The other thing, as you kind of brought up with Gettleman there, Gettleman made the point or said this past week, hey, we're not in the business of, and I'm paraphrasing here, but we're not in the business of giving away top talented players. You know, we don't want to give away these elite type players. And yet, look what he did with Josh Norman in Carolina. Look what he did previously with Steve Smith, who still had, you know, three good years left. So he's done it before.
Yep.
And though, as you pointed out, everything they've done kind of points to them loading up for a little short-term run here. I frankly can't figure out what exactly they're doing. They've got a new head coach in Pat Shurmur, new GM, trying to turn the page on last season, don't appear to be in rebuild mode, but they seem at least willing to, you know, set the price tag high for Beckham, but maybe they're willing to take less than two first-round picks. It wouldn't stun me either.
Yeah, we'll see. I think the two teams that could even think about doing something like that, and I'm still not sure, two first-rounders is just so much to give up, but you'd think obviously the Browns and the Bills are the ones with the way that they've been loading up their draft war chests are the clubs that can think about it. The problem is that the Browns and the Bills don't seem like an all-pro wide receiver away from competing for a Super Bowl just yet. So that would seem like the type of move you only make if it's going to truly put you over the top, and I'm just not so sure that either of those organizations are there yet. I still don't know, Eric. I mean, I keep not, pegging a quarterback at number two for the Giants, but who knows? Maybe they're just playing their cards really, really well, and they actually are locked in on a Josh Rosen or someone like that, and we're just kind of all assuming that it's all-in mode, and maybe that's not the direction they're going to go here in a couple of weeks.
Right.
I'm just not sure.
I'm with you there. It's not like signing Jonathan Stewart gives us a clear idea of what they're expected to this offseason, but or trading for Alec Ogletree, but you take on a big contract like that, you sort of think like, okay, they're just retooling a little bit here, and that they think this is closer to the defense they had, you know, or the team they had 2 years ago versus last year. So yeah, I'm with you. It's such a confusing map for them. And with all these other NFC teams doing what they're doing, I can't sit there and say, boy, just give him Beckham and make sure he's happy and everything will be fine. Look, he wants $20 million a year. I understand if they're not going to, you know, I would want more than just a great player for a guy I'm paying $20 million at a non-quarterback position. I would have to make sure that he's an elite player on the field and isn't going to give me headaches off it. And I don't know. That's just the feeling I have. So, yeah, I'm with you. The mystery of number two, they trade away JPP. Could they be taking Chubb? Do they have a quarterback they love? All those questions are still kind of on the tip of my brain.
I'll take it a step further, Eric. He's got to be transcendent on the field, and he literally has to be like an Ambien off of it. You do not want to be up at night wondering what's going on with this $20 million per year player. You got to sleep very comfortably if you're going to make that investment. So I do think it's going to take a new deal. I absolutely believe that report. I think NFL Media had it first that Odell needs a new deal from the Giants or elsewhere to be on the field. And I wonder if his representation doesn't decide. He's only 25. Maybe we do a shorter-term deal with a bunch of guaranteed money up front for a couple years and then kind of a reevaluate when he's still hitting the open market once again in his absolute prime.
Yeah, Zeke Sandu, his agent, has been known to, you know, try to work things favorably in terms of new teams and big money elsewhere for his players. I'm not saying he's a manipulator. I'm just saying he's been creative in terms of trying to land his players with other teams if they don't feel like they're going to get the deal done. So we'll have to see about that. A couple of trades that went down this week. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but Sua Cravens is one that we talked about in February, the possibility of him being traded. The Denver Broncos were mentioned at the time. That was the place that felt like, you know, the most connections were made to as far as a possible deal. Washington sends him to Denver in this very convoluted trade that essentially amounts to them swapping picks in rounds 4 or 5, et cetera. Extra fifth rounder goes to Washington. I think they get a conditional pick in a year or two as well. So a lot of picks change hands. It turns out that, you know, for the 51st pick in the draft a couple years ago, Cravens is being sold off about two quarters on the dollar. So just any thoughts on what Cravens brings to the Broncos, or was it just a case of the Washington wanting to move on from a player who, you know, frankly also gave them some headaches as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly that. I think Washington stopped trusting the dude. He kind of disappeared on him last year, and you hear it's an old adage. Anytime you hear a player even mention retirement, he's as good as retired already. A lot of NFL people believe that. And I kind of understand it. I think what's interesting about him going to Denver, well, John Elway had a pretty recent high-profile first-round pick who hasn't exactly been fully committed to the game. So now, not that he's giving up nearly as much. It's not like he traded up for, you know, like he did for a quarterback. But, you know, you just kind of wonder, is this going to be the right environment for him? You put him in there with Von Miller and Chris Harris. Is that what he needs to flourish? I'm not sure Washington had that same type of defensive leadership, that type of credibility. So maybe it's a great landing spot for him. All I know is I love the player, you know, coming out of USC. I still don't really know exactly what he's going to be in the NFL. I don't think anyone does, but he was an instinctive playmaker and kind of a hybrid guy in the way that the league's going. So I can certainly see the vision here for it. And I guess I can see why Washington would want to let him go. They've got a couple guys they're excited about, Monte Nicholson. They were able to re-sign Zach Brown. So they've got enough speed and physicality there, I think, to help replace a guy like Cravens.
Yeah, and I like Justin Simmons, their big safety as well. Kind of a rangy guy who can play the middle of the field and the deep portions of the field. You've got Cravens maybe to be that, you know, nickel defender underneath, can be a small linebacker, big box safety on running down. So, yeah, I mean, right, if he's committed, there's a good player there.
Right.
We just don't know where his head is. That's the biggest thing. And to your point about Elway, boy, you know, when he put together that defense, I mean, again, you can say what you want about nabbing Peyton Manning. That was obviously a brilliant stroke. You know, having some of the pieces necessary on offense. But to me, it was the way that Elway constructed that defense 3, 4, 5 years ago that I thought was brilliant. And I was giving him all the praise in the world. As you mentioned, the Paxton Lynch move has not panned out. They just signed Keenum. It will not work out in Denver. I don't believe Paxton Lynch has a future there. Immaturity, you know, lack of commitment, those sorts of things have been mentioned. You know, the recent draft picks, Garrett Bowles last year didn't play all that well as a rookie, started all the games, but penalty prone, you know, mistake prone, things like that. Other picks have failed. So, you know, he just signed a contract extension, Elway did, but boy, the bloom's a little off the rose on him now the last year or so.
Yeah, I think so. But he's another guy where you sense that clearly his moves this offseason reflect that he thinks that window is still open. He thinks that can still be a championship caliber defense. I like the move to go get Jared Veld here. I think that helps out Garrett Bowles and helps out the offensive line. Actually, it kind of reminds you a little bit of when they went and got Evan Mathis a couple years ago. Yep. A kind of a veteran plug-and-play guy. Not that Veldier played very well in the past couple years in Arizona, but I do think he'll bring a little bit of stability there. So, but you're right. I mean, you know, the quarterback position is what everyone looks at, and Elways has been handled, you know, uneven at best since getting Peyton Manning and getting that Super Bowl ring. So they'll be a fascinating team to watch. And we have to remember Vance Joseph was pretty close to not getting that bowl again to return for a second season too. So the Broncos have plenty of intrigue entering the year.
Yeah, a lot of changes. I mean, they a lot of guys have gone in, a lot of them gone out this past couple of weeks and months. So it's gonna be very interesting to see how that team ends up shaping out after the draft. We had a quarterback trade this week, Arthur. Very exciting stuff. Okay, maybe not thrilling exactly, but Cody Kessler leaves the Browns. They just signed Drew Stanton. They've got Tyrod Taylor. They're gonna draft a quarterback. We know all that. He goes to Jacksonville. Jacksonville only had one. They had Bortles. That was the only guy on the roster after Chad Henne had left for a similar type backup job in Kansas City. So,
right.
I don't know. Does Kessler intrigue you at all? I guess there's not much. You know, he's traded for nothing. But really, it was, I guess, a good situation for him in that he's one snap away from starting versus completely out of the picture in Cleveland.
Yeah, Eric, I'm not a big Cody Kessler guy, but interestingly, the guy I liked better, and I believe it was from that same draft class, and I liked him watching him down in Mobile. I don't remember if it was on the same
Brandon
team.
Allen?
Exactly. The last guy they had from Arkansas, who I think now is where? He's somewhere out west. He was grabbed off the practice squad in Jacksonville and flipped posts. I'll have to check and see where he is now. But sort of a similar type of player anyway. It's interesting to put Kessler's numbers side by side with Blake Bortles. Is obviously a much smaller sample size, but it's pretty clear that what Tom Coughlin and Dave Caldwell value in Cody Kessler is the decision-making. I think it's the accuracy. And when you look at the way they're building that team up, Eric, of course, to be defense and run game first, you could see a scenario where someone like Cody Kessler, if needed, and I was kind of more joking when I was stoking the flames of saying there's going to be a quarterback competition. I think Blake Bortles showed a lot in January, and I don't think that should occur, at least not out of the gate. But you can see where Kessler might be the kind of guy that would be a good backup who can get you through a spell if they need him to because of some of those traits I mentioned.
Yeah, he had that one game, I guess that would have been 2 years ago, 2016, late in the season. He had that one game against the Titans, now a division opponent. But I thought, wow, geez, he's not that bad. Because, I mean, I had major questions about him coming out. He was this sort of short guy, you know, kind of a, you know, limp-armed quarterback, smart, but regressed his final year at USC and all that. But then he had that one game and just never put it together. He's 0-8 as a starter. So we obviously know that, you know, he wasn't playing with a good team. But still, this is a guy with limited upside. And I think they draft someone, too. It just, you know, it lines up with Bortles' contract so that, you know, a year from now, they still could move on from the guy, even with the contract extension, if anything, that's kind of greases the wheels for that if Bortles doesn't play well. So,
sure.
You know, maybe they draft somebody like a Luke Falk or whoever in the middle rounds and can get him through from that point. So, yeah, I guess it is. Do you think they're one of those teams, though, that could maybe – you know, take a Mason Rudolph, high second round, late first, or Lamar Jackson or somebody like that. Is there still a possibility of them taking a quarterback in the first, you know, 50, 60 picks, something like that?
I say absolutely. They're no different than the team that traded for Tyrod Taylor and the team that just traded away Cody Kessler. Those are kind of Band-Aid moves. And yeah, I mean, there was nothing about that Blake Bortles contract extension that told me the Jaguars are now sold on Blake Bortles as the future at the position. So, no, I would expect the Jaguars to be looking early for a quarterback. And you know, Kessler is a conditional seventh-round pick, so it's not like they really gave up anything to get him. A move that makes sense, I think, for both sides. But, Eric, I just have to – I love – the way that the Browns are suddenly quarterback sellers. I guess we know how they felt about the guy Sashi Brown picked. I understand the regime has changed, but there's some kind of irony. I don't even know if it's irony, but there's something that I laugh about in thinking that the least stable quarterback franchise in the NFL has dealt two of them in the matter of a couple weeks this offseason.
And got a starting defensive back for one, you know, right. For one of them. That's the crazy part with DeShone Kizer going to Green Bay, Demarius Randall coming in. Fascinating stuff indeed. All right, more – quarterback news, more short quarterback news, perhaps. We'll see. We'll pump the brakes a little bit. There's been a little bit of buzz around Johnny Manziel. I don't want to, you know, let's not go crazy because the guy still has a million questions to answer, but showed up at the University of San Diego Pro Day as kind of a throwing quarterback that needs somebody to throw there. From what I was able to tell, you know, it was a perfectly fine workout, nothing special. USD doesn't exactly have a lot of NFL talent there. Right. Then a couple days later, he goes to Texas A&M, and there's a little bit of buzz. There's a little bit of a talk of, hey, maybe he can still play in the league. We don't know about the off-field stuff. He said all the right things. But, Arthur, I guess I'll paint it. I'll ask you the same type of question I asked with Odell Beckham being traded. Percentage chances that he ends up on an NFL roster, Johnny Manziel, sometime in the next, let's say, 9 months, you know, I'll give you to the end of the year. Is there any shot, or do you think he's still bound for that spring league and gonna, you know, be a CFL quarterback or never amount to anything? I mean, how do you handicap this thing?
Yeah, I think it's going to be more than 9 months. But I thought the biggest takeaway for me from that Texas A&M Pro Day appearance was that he had changed his tune on being willing to go to the CFL. I think that's a big deal, Eric, because just as recently as I think a month ago or less, he said he wasn't looking to do that. Of course, the Hamilton Ticats and June Jones is the coach there, has a contract out there for him. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. That's a guy with some NFL skins on the wall, and nothing against the spring league. I don't pretend to know a ton about it, but I know that it doesn't have the reputation that the CFL does for, and not that the CFL has a long list of players who've went on to the NFL and thrived, but at least it has a list, unlike this new kind of spring league in its early infancy. So, look, I think the NFL is still intrigued with Johnny Manziel. I really do. I think he weighs 25, 26 years old. I'm still intrigued with him. I'm actually quietly find myself starting to pull for him, which I didn't think was going to be the case after as many, you know, missteps as he had made. But I do think that he has burned enough bridges that it's going to take more time than just a couple pro day appearances and a couple interviews to prove to NFL teams that he's truly committed. I'm curious to hear your take on this because, you know, he's still a dynamic guy and I think he can still put butts in the seats, but an NFL team has to be convinced it's not going to get burned.
Yeah, my take is that you've gone soft in your old age, man. You're pulling for this? No, I'm kidding. It would be a fascinating story if he came back. If he had any opportunity as a, you know, as a fourth quarterback trying to scrap his way onto our roster in preseason, people would watch. People, you know, the NFL's Twitter account has been, you know, following his every movement. So there's at least that buzz that you said amongst fans and observers, people who watched him, you know, dissect Alabama when he was in college, who knows what kind of talent he has, even with all the shortcomings, even with all the questions about substance abuse, all this other stuff that comes along with Johnny. So
let me ask you real quick, Eric, because it's been a couple years now, just from a pure football vantage point, what did you think? How did you scout him coming out? What did you think his outlook looked like just on the football field?
Yeah, I think I had him sort of in the mix of that was, I believe, or correct me if I'm wrong, that was the Teddy Bridgewater, Blake Bortles.
Correct.
Year, right? Okay. You know, I did the kind of cop-out thing and where I kind of stacked those guys all similarly. And it's not terribly different. It's different, but it's not terribly different to what I have this year where I have Josh Rosen as my top quarterback. I have, you know, Mayfield and Darnold right there behind them. They're all kind of in that same vicinity. Those guys, I want to say, I think I had them all ranked overall between like 13th and 20th. So I thought there was a chance that Manziel could actually be a starting quarterback. I didn't know. No one could have, I guess. But he just didn't put in the time. He wasn't a defense reader. He wasn't a film study guy. He wasn't a worker. He wasn't a grinder. And he had natural ability that carried him to a certain point. And then he, on top of that, was partying and getting distracted by all these things. So I don't know. Maybe I overrated a little bit, but I can't get that Alabama game out of my head where the whole field was in play. And he just looked like he had one of the best defenses in the country, you know, just spinning it on its finger almost. So, yeah, I probably overrated that game and a few other performances. But, He could do a lot. He was a thrill-a-minute player in college.
Yeah, no question. That 2014 draft era could become kind of 2012-esque in that Derek Carr and Jimmy Garoppolo, both round two quarterbacks, and that you just mentioned the guys in round one. And, of course, everyone remembers 2012 with Luck and RG3 and what was it, Brandon Whedon, and then guys like Russell Wilson and Kirk Cousins going later on. So we'll be fascinating to see when we look back on that one even a couple more years from now.
And who knows? Maybe this year, Lamar Jackson, Mason Rudolph.
Yes. You know, Kyle LaLetta.
Our guy. Luke Falk is at least, somebody you have to talk about. So, right. Perhaps there's a little bit of a mirror image in this one. All right. Well, that's going to do it for the Pro Football Weekly podcast. Thank you all for listening and appreciate the hard work of Dan Motter, producer, who does a great job on the show each and every week. And send us some questions. Check us out on Twitter. PF Weekly is the handle there. Arthur Arkish, is there an underscore in there? No?
I don't think so. No, just at Arthur Arkish and at Eric Edholm, I believe, as well, right?
There is an underscore in mine. It's Eric. Because if you write Eric Edholm, it looks like E. Rice DeHolm. It just doesn't, It's odd. So I had to do the underscore. So that's me on Twitter. Check us out and let us know what you want to hear on next week's podcast. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.